realize I didn't even get my conclusions. So let's go through the conclusions. Let's see if you remember them. According to what we now know about Mecca, Mecca is foundational for both Muhammad and the Quran, so without it, they both fall. The references to Mecca in the Quran and the traditions do not hold up historically, or geographically, or linguistically. What's more, neither the prophets supposedly buried there, nor the ancient maps of Ptolemy's, nor the Qiblas of Gibson's, support an early Mecca. Neither the land trade route or the western on the Western Plateau, nor the Red Sea trade route in the African coast supports an early Mecca. Topographical maps prove Mecca is off the Western Plateau and is in a desert with no water. Thus, the reason no civilization surrounding Arabia has heard of Mecca, as people need water. The five stages of the Hajj, the Kaaba, the Safa and Marwa, the Arafat, Jamarat, Zamzam, and the Black Stone support Jerusalem and not Mecca. Someone, somewhere, at some time, should have known about this city, yet no one anywhere, nor at any time, has, proving that it has never existed at the time of Muhammad, nor during early Islam. So, obviously, this brings a problem to early Islam. Let's go into, see, and see what the evidence is on the ground. Now, notice, everything I'm going to do from here on out is only from the 7th century. When I did my first debate in 1995 with Dr. Jamal Badawi, his first response was, Jay, you have no evidence. Absence of silence does not prove silence of absence. Or no, the absence of evidence does not prove evidence of absence, which is what you've heard all the time. And that was true. I really had no evidence to support what I was saying. It was just silence. Well, you're going to see that we now have the evidence. They have the silence. So let's look at it, what we do have. To begin with, let's remember, according to the standard Islamic narrative, Mecca Medina was what controlled all of Islamic empire from Afghanistan in the east all the way to Tripoli in the west. Tripoli is Libya today. If that is so, all of the coins should be from that part of the world. Yet look where the mints are from the 7th and 8th century. On the west, western mints are Tartus, Homs, Baalbek, Dimashq, Tabriz, Abila, Baisan, Jarash, Aman, Yubna, and Ilya. You notice none of them are in Arabia. All the coins made in all the mints in the west part are in what is today Jordan, Syria, and Israel and Lebanon. On the eastern side, they are from Susa, Dasht, Arajan, Bishapur, Ishtkar, Dadad. I'm not going to destroy the language. You can read them yourself. Those are all Zoroastrian. That is Persian. They're all Persian mints. None of them are down where they're supposed to be. And remember, this is one thing you need to know. For anybody to come to power back in the 7th century, you don't have radio, you don't have television, you don't have the internet. How do you introduce yourself? You use coins. You always use coins. You introduce brand new coins, and you put your name on the coins. You put your image on the coins, and you put your denomination, what religion you belong to. Everyone did that back then. Look at all the coins. They all have a religious denomination. So you pretty well know who they are just by looking at the coins. Why is it there are no mints down here? There's no water. Bingo. Okay, that's all I need to say. There's no water. So all of these mints would have been under the authority of any Arab leader or any Muslim leader or caliph in the 7th century, including the Muslim caliphs. Nonetheless, none of these mints were from the Hejaz. Instead, they were all situated too far north. It's becoming like a broken record. So let's look at the coins then and what we're finding. Using a timeline, let's look and see at the coins. And this is coming out of the numismatists. I got in touch with them 2 years ago, and this is what blew open everything, because I noticed that they had coins after coins from this part of the world in Arabic from supposedly the caliphs that were there, but none of them used the word caliph. That word was never used. Amir was used, but not caliph. So the coins do exist. You can buy them. You can get them today. Now, we know that Muhammad died in 632, but there's no Islamic coin whatsoever with his name on it. If he was really the caliph up until 632, from 624, then where's his coins? None. The Sassanians have coins, and the Western mints have coins, and there are lots of rulers, because these were all nomadic, these were tribal states, and they're in Arabic. No reference whatsoever to anybody who's a Muslim. There's no Abu Bakr, there's no Umar, there's no Uthman, there's no Ali at all on any of these coins. What's more, all of the coins have crosses on them. Why would you have a cross unless you were a Christian? These were all Christians. So let's get to Muawiyah, the first Muslim caliph from the Umayyad period, 661. Lots of history about him because he has lots of coins. He's living in Damascus, and so what does he do? He introduces his coins. What's on his coins? His image is on this coin. His name is on the coins. And what's above his head? A cross. And what is he holding? A cross. He is not a Muslim. No Muslim would be holding a cross. Look at the coins. The coins are very clear. There is no Muslim whatsoever from 661 up until 680. So now we're a good 50 years after Muhammad has died, and still we can't find anything Islamic on any of the coins. Does that not bother any of you? Is this not evidence from the 7th century? These are all Arab coins. They're all from that part of the world. Notice, not one of them is from Mecca or Medina. Why? No water. Then we get to Abd al-Malik. Abd al-Malik introduces his coins, and he has gold solidises. He is, notice, both Muawiyah, who is from the Sufyani family, and Abd al-Malik, who is the Marwanid family of the Umayyad Caliphate, they are in Damascus. What are they doing in Damascus? Why aren't they in Mecca, Medina? No water. Simple as that. That is where the trade is. That's where the people live. That's where the vegetation is. That is where the civilizations are. Damascus is one of the oldest cities in the history of mankind. That's why they're in Damascus. He puts out coins. He is sick and tired of coming under domination of the Byzantines, so he introduces this coin right here. And on this coin, it's a mockery of the Byzantine emperor and his two sons. And then he takes off the crosses. He is the first to take off the cross because he is an anti-Trinitarian Christian. He is a Christian, but he's anti-Trinitarian. He is against the Trinity. He is against Jesus Christ as God. He then puts up the dome. He builds the Dome of the Rock. You can see it today. Go to the Dome of the Rock. Look at the inscriptions, the only original part of the building that's still there. It's from Shura, chapter 4, verse 171. Say not three, for God is one, and he has no son. Who is that against? Jesus, the divinity, the Trinity, and his sonship. For truly, neither is God begotten, nor does he beget. Who is that against? That's Surah 112. Against John 3:16. For la ilaha illallah, for there's only one God but God, and Muhammad, that means the praised one, is nothing more than the servant of God. It's all about Jesus. It's attacking his divinity. It's right there in black and white. You can read it today. But you've got to remember, there's no man named Muhammad this early. There is a title Muhammad, and this title has to do with Jesus. So all the coins are attacking Jesus. They're attacking the Trinity. There's a sectarian battle going on here, from the anti-Trinitarians to the Trinitarians. The Trinitarians are in the cities, and Abd al-Malik comes, and he is an anti-Trinitarian, and he attacks the Byzantine emperor. He then goes to war against Justinian II. He beats Justinian II. Justinian II is absolutely beside himself. So Abd al-Malik introduces this coin in 693 with his image on it. Hold on a minute. I thought Muslims couldn't have images. There's his picture on it, holding a sword. This is his triumphal entry. He now is saying, I am the big man. We are now against the Trinity. We are now anti-Trinitarians. And then he takes his image off and introduces this coin in 696. This is the Shahada. It's attacking Jesus. It's attacking the Trinity. It's attacking the divinity. It's chapter 4, verse 171. It's a chapter 112. Folks, just read the coins. They'll tell you what's happening. This has nothing to do with Islam. It's all to do with an internecine Trinitarian debate. And guess who won? The anti-Trinitarians won. Because of Abd al-Malik. That's why I wanted you to put his name at the very beginning. He is what Islam then became. But he was not a Muslim. There's no reference to any people called Muslims yet. There's no reference to any religion called Islam yet. Not in 691. This is 60 years after Muhammad died, if there was a Muhammad. Are you following me? Just follow the coins. Now, Let's look at the rock inscription. See, I love coins, I love rocks because they don't deteriorate, they don't disintegrate. They're still there looking at us today. You can still read them. They're all in Arabic. Just read the Arabic. The Arabic is all Nabataean Aramaic, way up from Jordan. So none of these rock inscriptions are from the right place. They're either in the north or they're in the south. If they're in the north, they're Nabataean Aramaic. If from the south, they're Sabaic Arabic. Nothing to do with Mecca and Medina. Why is it that none of these are from the middle? Why are they not from Mecca and Medina? There's no water. Just remember, there's no water. But when you look at these inscriptions, you need to go to Ilke Lindstedt's doctoral thesis. He did his doctoral thesis looking at 100 years between 640 to 740. So he's looking at the time that after Muhammad, if there's no Muhammad, forget about Muhammad right now, beginning of what we know as the Arab conquest. This is where Arabs are coming to the fore, up until the time the Abbasids come to power. So this is including the entire period of the Umayyad dynasty. Looking at the rock inscription, and this is what he found. Prior to 690, there's nothing whatsoever Islamic on any of the rock inscriptions. There's a lot of what we know as formula. Everything comes from, but all the formula is pious. There's nothing to do with Muhammad, nothing to do with Islam, nothing to do with Muslims, nothing to do with the Quran, and nothing to do with Mecca. The five things that you'd find on any of these inscriptions are not at all up before 690. And then in 690 to 710, the next 20 years, then the Prophet Muhammad starts to appear. The name starts to appear as a person named Muhammad. But that is in the 8th century. We're now well into the Umayyad period. From 710 to 720, you start hearing about the Muslim rites, such as the pilgrimage and the prayer and the fast. And it's not until 720 to 730, this is 100 years after Muhammad died, if he did live, that you find the word Muslim and that you find Islam appears. This is the beginning, the end of the Umayyad period. This is the beginning, starting to be the beginning of the Abbasid period. This shows that this specific group of people called Muslims were in contradistinction to Christianity. Conclusion, it was only after the 730s and onwards that there is evidence of a popular devotion to a man named Muhammad as a prophet and messenger, which makes the Islamic traditions incredibly awkward. But folks, all I'm showing you is evidence from the 7th and 8th century that is still in existence today. There is 100-year silence prior to this that indicates that Islam did not exist as a distinct religion until long after the time of Muhammad, which casts doubt on whether he had any part in starting Islam. Now, there are no coins anywhere in Central Arabia, and the Arabia coins, which do exist, these are the conclusion, are all further north and are all Christian up to and including the time of Muawiyah. It is only with the coins introduced by Abd al-Malik that we begin to possibly find what we would call Islamic, but we're now finding they are not Islamic at all, though they could still be referencing Jesus or even the Caliph, though they are all anti-Trinitarian. The rock inscriptions are similar to the coins, with nothing Islamic prior to 690. Then references to Muhammad from 690 to 710, Muslim rites and pilgrimage prayer and fast from 710 to 720, and finally the names Muslim and Islam referencing a group which is not Christian from 720 to 30. This suggests that there is an internecine clash between different sects within Christianity. Let me repeat that. This is an internecine clash between the Trinitarians and the anti-Trinitarians, which started to become its own religion at the end of the Umayyad dynasty, which then became the Islam of today during the initial 100 to 200 years of the Abbasid dynasty in the 8th to 10th century. Now, can you then understand? Well, hold on. We'll come back to that. Let's go to the Quran. And this is the mother load. This is the big material. This is the stuff that we're getting on that gets me, keeps me up all night. I love this stuff. Because when you get to the Quran, you need to ask, what is the Quran? This is the book that the Muslims follow, and this book they believe is eternal. It has always existed. That's in chapter 85, verse 21 and 22 of the Quran, the preserved tablets. So this has never had any human interference. All right? Do we make that claim about the Bible? Say no. Of course it's not eternal. It's written by men. We know who wrote it. We know when they wrote it. We even know the names of many of those who wrote it. Not this book. This has no human intervention. It was sent down to a man named Muhammad between 610 and 632, that 22-year period. According to them, it was completed by Uthman in 652, about 20 years later. And since that time, the time of Uthman till today, not one word, not one letter has changed. Have you heard Muslims say this all the time? This is not new to you. All right, so those are the four claims about the Quran. Uncreated, sent down, complete, unchanged. Just remember those four words. That's all you need to remember, all right? Muslims want to repeat it if you don't. I am not interested in the first two because I'm not there in the 7th century. I have not been there since eternity, so I cannot really confront that. What I can confront are the last two claims. Was it complete? Has it been changed? That's all you need to confront. Let's just ask those two questions. So let's look at a timeline. Now, according to the Islamic narrative, Muhammad dies in 632. When he dies, there was no Quran. It had not been written down. There are a group of Muslims up in Yamama, at the Battle of Yamama. About 70 Muslims, according to this standard Islamic narrative, were killed at the Battle of Yamama, which caused the crisis. Because many of those who died had memorized the Quran. If they all died, there's no Quran. So immediately, Abu Bakr had Zayd ibn Thabit, who is the secretary of Muhammad, to write the Quran down, quickly to write it down. Zayd ibn Thabit said, how can I do something the Prophet didn't do? He said, man, nonetheless, do it. So he did it. How did he do it? He took it from bones, he took it from stones, he took it from pieces of palm leaves, and he took it from the memorization of those who were still alive. That became the Quran, given to Abu Bakr, who gave it to Umar's daughter, Hafsa, who had been a wife of Muhammad. She put it under her bed. The only Quran that exists, and she stuck it under her bed. That's rather inept, isn't it? Why would you stick a Quran under your bed if it's the only one that exists? Nonetheless, she kept it there for 20 years. Let's then jump to 652. In 652, 20 years later, they had another battle, the Battle of Azerbaijan. And there were some Muslims who went from Medina up to Azerbaijan. They fought against the Azerbaijanis. After the battle, they went into a mosque to pray. And there were other Muslims from Iraq and other Muslims from Damascus. When they heard them praying, they noticed that they had two completely different Qurans. And so they started fighting each other. Boom, 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 boom. And then, of course, this bothered the Medinans, so they came back down to Medina and they talked to Uthman. They said, we've got to do something. We've got to have one Quran. One Quran, because we cannot be like the Christians, have many different Qurans. So they get that Quran that was sitting under that bed for 20 years that was written by Zayd ibn Thabit. They wake up Zayd ibn Thabit and have to tell him to rewrite it again. And this time in the Qurayshi dialect, so that there will not be any other Qurans. Just one Qurayshi dialect. Qurayshi dialect. Dialect. Arabic dialect. Does anybody see a problem with that? Anybody know Arabic here? Anybody know Arabic? Nobody? Oh. Okay, then I can say anything and you'll believe me. In Arabic, you have 14 consonantal letters in the 7th century. 14 consonantal, many of them are just little pieces, like a little bowl. And now if you read that, you don't know what it is. It could be anything, a little bowl shake, a smiley face. So in the 7th century, there was a problem because you could put three of them together, you could put four of them together, and you wouldn't know what you're reading. So they had to do something. In the 7th century, Nabataean Aramaic had only these consonantal letters, 14 of them. If you look at Arabic today, there are 28 letters. So what happened between the 7th century and the 8th century? They invented five dots. So you put one dot above that little bowly face, and you get a na, or an N sound. If you put two dots, it's a T sound. Three dots, it's a TH sound, na, ta, tha. One dot below, it's a B sound. Two dots, it's a Y sound. So, natathabahya. Five now letters out of one smiley face. But that was only introduced in the 8th century, not the 7th century, not at the time of Uthman. So, in order to have dialectical differences in a written text, you also need three vowels, the Dhamma, the Kasra, and the Fatha. The Dhamma is the U sound, the Kasra is the E sound, and the Fatha is the A, U, A, E. Three vowels. Five dots, three vowels. None of them existed in the 7th century. To have a dialectical difference, you need to have those dots and vowels. So how can you have a dialectical difference in the 7th century? Do you see a problem here? So where does this story come from? It comes from Al-Bukhari. When did Al-Bukhari die? 870. That's the 9th century, when dots have been around for over 100 years. He's redacting it back without even knowing his Arabic. Bingo. Can you see why the Germans are so clever? Don't you love the Germans? They've said, they've known this since the 1920s. They said, folks, you can't have dialectical differences in the 7th century. This is all fraudulent. But then we can understand why. Because this was not even written by Al-Bukhari. There's no documents of Al-Bukhari. This is from the Ottoman period, redacting it back on the 7th century, and it's 800 years too late. Bingo. That's why everybody is now laughing. Well, we're laughing. So you cannot have a dialectical difference in the 7th century. That's all you need to know. So what did he do next? Well, according to what the maps show us and what the traditions show us, here you have five cities. You see them out there? I'm going to put them in green for you so you can see exactly. You have down here, you have Mecca, Medina, Basra, Kufa, and Damascus. Those are the five cities that copies of this final Quran were sent to. So they would not have this problem again. They would only have one Quran with one dialect in those five cities. Pretty smart. The problem is, where are they today? We're talking about 652. Ask any Muslim to show you where one of those Qurans is today. Not one exists. That's pretty inept of Muslims. If this is the greatest book in the history of mankind, if these are the five Qurans that were written so there would be no changes ever again, and they've lost all five of them. We can't find one. Not one exists today. Oh, they'll say that the top copy, we'll get into that. They'll say the manuscripts are, I'll show you when they were written. None of them were written in the 7th century. What's more than, but it gets worse than that. Because the traditions then say that a Quran was put together up here in Damascus by a man named Ubay ibn Ka'b. And his Quran had 116 surahs. There's only 114 surahs in today's Quran. So that's obviously a different Quran than one we have today. Then another one suddenly appeared up here in Basra, written by Ibn Mas'ud, and it had 111 surahs. 110, sorry. That's four surahs less, fewer than the one we have today. So obviously, two completely different Qurans than another one written by Ibn Musa here in Basra. That's why I haven't been read. Three different Qurans, according to the traditions, when Dr. Arthur Jeffrey did his doctoral thesis back in 1930s, he came up with 15,000 differences. And yet Muslims say there's only one Quran. Not one word, not one letter has been changed. There were at least five Qurans in the 7th century, Mecca, Medina, Basra, Kufa, and Damascus. We don't have one of them today. If Allah is able to preserve his Quran perfectly, then there should be at least five complete Qurans in existence in the Muslim world. So where are they today? Well, let's look. Let's look. Now listen, as Christians, we say the same thing. We don't have the original manuscripts of the New Testament, do we? But we do have three metropolitan codices, the Sinaiticus, the Alexandrinus, the Vaticanus, right? Those are metropolitan codices from the 4th century that you have two of them right here in London. Have you seen them? Please go. If not, shame on you. You need to see them so you can say you've seen them. From the 4th century, that's 300 years before Islam. If we can come up with three metropolitan codices that are complete New Testaments 300 years from before Islam, why can't the Muslims come up with one? Okay, hold on to that, hold on to that. That's a good point, but hold on, you're 100 years too early. Take that back 8th century, and we're going to get to that. So here you have a problem. So how many, we have three metropolitan codices, we have 8,500 Greek manuscripts, we have 10,000 Latin Vulgates, we have 9,000 in 11 different languages, that's roughly 24,000 manuscripts we can look at of the New Testament alone to see if there are any differences. And we know where all the differences are. We're very transparent about it. So how many manuscripts do the Muslims have? Let's count them. Here's the first one. How come you know so much? Because you're reading my material. Okay, all right. Number one, the top copy. This is the best they have got. This is from the mid 8th century. Let me repeat that. Mid 8th century, it's the most complete Quran. It's in the Topkapi Palace there in Istanbul. It is actually, in fact, this is your picture, Will. This is yours. You guys took this picture when you were there in the Topkapi Palace. You're not permitted to. Naughty, naughty on him. Thank God you did that. It is about 99% of what the Quran is today, yet it has 2,270 manuscript variants. Let me repeat that. 2,270 different words and phrases that are different from the Quran we have today. So even by the mid-8th century, it's still not complete. Are you following that? Here's the second one, the Samarkand. It's in Uzbekistan. It only goes up to Surah 43. There's 114 surahs. But within those 43 surahs, there's only one complete surah. The other ones, 16 of them are not complete, which means most of the Quran is missing out of this one. It has hundreds of manuscript variants. In fact, it is written by so many different scribes who did not know their grammar. Most Muslim scholars say, don't even read it. It's an embarrassment. This is from the mid to late 8th century. Then we have the, this is right here in London. It's at the Rydberg Gallery, there in the British Library. You can go see it. This is a slanted script. It only goes up to Surah 43. It's missing half the Quran. It's about 50% of the Quran. It also has manuscript variants, but it is one of the nicest ones because it is using what we call the Ma'il text, which means the slanted text, the Hijazi text. The Petropolitan, this is the one that's in Paris. It is only about 23% of the Quran. It is in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. It is put controlled by Dr. François de Roche. It has about 93 different manuscript variants in the Quran we have today. And then you get the Husseini manuscript. The Husseini is in Egypt, in Cairo. This one is a real embarrassment because this one is, though it's a 9th century, it's a huge monumental text copied after the biblical text. When you look at it, it has hundreds and hundreds of coverings and coverings and coverings, sanitizing, changing the text so that nobody can see what's underneath, which means it has been standardized during the Ottoman period in the last 700 years, proving that it's probably a completely different text. And then the most exciting, the Sana'a manuscript, discovered in 1975, was not allowed access to any Europeans until 1981. The Germans were sent down because they were the only ones that could read it. Take a look at why. You can see there are no dots and vowels. Notice every one of these that I've been showing you, there are no dots and vowels. Have you noticed that? There are no dots above any lines, no vowels above. There's no Dhamma, no Kasra al-Fatha. These all predate the dots and vowels. Yet they're all 8th and 9th century manuscript. Not one of them is 7th century. Not one of them is from the time of Muhammad. Not one of them is from the time of Uthman. 6 manuscripts, yet what's the problem with them? First of all, you can see, when you look at the Sana'a manuscript, I just want to show you something here. That's Surah 19, then you have that yellow mark, and there's Surah 20, 22. What happened to Surah 20 and 21? Well, it appears over here on another page. Look at those. There's 2 completely different scripts. There's about 60 years between those 2 scripts, which means this was added much later in a completely different script. Every time you see an orange mark, see those orange marks? Those are manuscript variants. That means words or letters that are different from the Quran we have today. And none of them have to do with dots and vowels. They all are consonantal, which means they're completely different words. Ooh, I love that. It makes my job easy. So, summary. None of the manuscripts are from the 7th century. None of them are complete. None of them completely agree with each other. None of them completely agree with the current 1924 Hafs text. All of them have hundreds or even thousands of subsequent manuscript variants. So when was there a complete Quran? Well, the Muslims thought they found it here in Birmingham Library. You remember this one? 2015? All over the news. We finally found the Quran, the original Quran. Dr. David Thomas said, the writer of this manuscript could well have known the Prophet Muhammad. He would have seen him probably. He would have maybe had even heard him preach. He may have known him personally. And that really is quite a thought to conjure with. A full Quran dated from 568 to 645 using carbon dating from the Oxford Laboratory. 568 to 645, they've now find the full Quran. It's only 2 pages, front and back, 33 verses. What's interesting, it is Arabic, it is from the Quran. It's only 33 verses out of 6,236 in the Quran. It covers bits of Surah 18, Surah 19, and Surah 20, which means 33 verses out of 343 verses, which is only 10% of those 3 surahs. And what's more, take a look at what it has to say. It talks about the 7 sleepers of Ephesus. That has nothing to do with Islam. It talks about the Protoevangelium of James. That has nothing to do with Islam. And it talks about the story of Moses. That has nothing to do with Islam. These are all pre-Islamic. These are stories that were there long before the Quran, long before Muhammad, all in Arabic, and you'll see why in just about 10 minutes. This is not a surprise. Of course it's pre-Islamic, because where did the Quran get its material from? These stories. Muslims haven't dared to mention this to the public, so we're doing it for them. Then we get to this is the best stuff. Everyone Muslim that you have met have said this is the only Quran, right? There's only one Quran in the world. And this is it, not the English, the Arabic. You've heard this from every Muslim. One Quran, not one word, not one letter different. How many of you believe that? Can you prove that? I see a lot of you shaking your head. Can you prove that there's more than one Quran? Yeah, because of Hatun Tosh. Because of Hatun Tosh. 5 foot two. Her father was an imam, well-known imam in Turkey. She fell in love with Jesus Christ when she read the Bible for the first time. Who wouldn't? Told her father, had to flee out of Turkey, came to Oxford, was my student there at Oxford, at the Oka Center of Christian Apologetics. She thought I was arrogant because I come across as that. And she decided she didn't want anything to do with me, but I said I was going to Speaker's Corner that Sunday, so she came on down to Speaker's Corner and never has stopped coming. I was with her on the ladder last Sunday. She was there today. She's there every day. This woman, I don't know what to say about her, but she is amazing. She went down to Morocco to teach some missionaries there about the Islam. Of course, she needed an Arabic Quran. Not speaking Arabic herself, because she's Turkish, she went into an Arabic store and said, could you please sell me an Arabic Quran? He said, well, which one? She said, what do you mean, which one? And he said, we have Kalloon here, we have Wadish here, we have Hafs here, we have Taif over here. She said, well, give them all to me. So she brought six of these Qurans back to London, showed them to me, and I started laughing. I had no idea that you could buy these Arabic Qurans. I knew what these are. These are the qira'ats. These are the ahrufs. These are the readings. What am I talking about? Well, when you have Qurans, when you have to put together a book for a man, because now you have a prophet, you need a book. Every prophet has a book. What do? You've got to start borrowing. Where do you go? Who are the only people you can borrow from? The Jews and the Christians, right? So you go to the Jewish apocryphal writings, which is what you've seen, one of Moses that you saw in Surah 19 in the slide before. But most of what you want to do is you want to go to the Christians. Problem is the Christians don't use Arabic. They use Aramaic. All the Christians in the 7th century spoke and did Aramaic in the theological colleges and all of the theological training. You're an Arab. You don't speak Aramaic, so you've got to borrow. What do? You borrow from the Aramaic, which has the same roots, but they have dots, and you take off their dots, and you put your own dots in. But you decide to put your dots where you want to, and you decide to put your dots where you want to, and you call yours Hafs, and you call yours Warsh, because your name is Warsh, and you're asleep, but when you wake up, you put your dots when you want to, and you call yours Kalloon, and then you put your dots where you want to, and you call yourself Al-Kisai, right? Now, you're four different dots, four different sets of dots. You live in Cairo, you live in Kufa, you live in Damascus, and you live somewhere in, let's just say, Basra, okay? Four different cities, four different sets of dots, and you've got a problem. Because none of you have looked at each other's dots. So yours is different than his, and different than hers, and different than hers. Do you see a problem here? Well, this started proliferating, so they had almost 700 different Qurans by the 10th century. 700 different Qurans. It was a dilemma. So they had this man here, Ibn Mujahid, choose seven of them. He didn't open one book. He didn't look at one word. He chose yours because you have more disciples, and he liked you because you have a lot of disciples, and he likes you because you have a lot of disciples. He chose whoever had the most popular and put them. So he came up with Nafi, Ibn Kathir, Abu Amr, Ibn Amir, Asim, Hamza, and Al-Kasai. This is the first seven that were chosen. But look at the date. In 936, this is the 10th century. So this is 300 years after Muhammad. These seven are chosen. And these are known as the creme de la creme by all Muslims. You'll hear them say this all the time. These are the companions of the Prophet. Are they? Look when they died. 785, 738, 770, 736, 745. Did any of these know Muhammad? Did any of them even live in the same century he lived in? Did any of them come from Mecca? Well, two of them did. Can you see a problem there? But that still wasn't enough. So then in the 12th century, this guy chose 14 more, two from every one of those. His name is Al-Shatibi. Look at the date, 1194. This is, folks, 500 years after Muhammad. He chooses another 14. That's still not enough. Then you have our Jazari. He chooses another nine in 1429. This is 800 years after Muhammad. These 30 are chosen. These are the 30 standard Qurans, all in Arabic. They're over 1,000 years old, and you can buy them on the internet today. Here are two of them right here. These are the two most popular ones in the world today. This one is Hafs. This one is Warsh. Hafs and Warsh. This man lived in Kufa, hundreds of miles further north. He died in 796. That's 144 years after Muhammad. This man lived in Cairo, in Egypt. He died in 812. Can you see? Neither of these two guys knew Muhammad. They have two completely different Qurans. Between these two books, there are 5,000 different words. That means 5,000 different meanings. That means 5,000 different doctrines, different theologies, and different practices. Have any of you heard this before? We went down, Hatun and I, back in 2016 and held these up along with 24 that she had found. She found 26 of them. We held them up for the whole world to see. We did this because this one here, the Hafs, has now become the standard. But hold on, we'll tell you about that in just a bit. Now, her team here in London has now found 93,000 differences between these 30 Qurans. 93,000 differences. That means different words, different theologies, different beliefs, different practices. And you've not, none of you heard this before. Do you see how easy this is? So when a Muslim says that this is God's eternal word that has never changed, not one word, one letter, just show them this graph. Show them that picture. We went down to Speaker's Corner and she decided to take her 26, and these are the 26 she came up with. I won't read them all because they'll go too quick. I just want to share this. She collected herself in Jordan, in Syria, in Yemen. You can buy them. She has them all today. Actually, she has gone beyond that. She has found 37 of them now. Not one of them is the same. Not one of them is the same. All of them in Arabic, and they're all from the 8th, 9th, and 10th century. Ooh, I love it. We took them down to Speaker's Corner. Caused such a havoc when we did that back in 2016. They tried to grab them out of our hands. We went back three times. The last time, we almost didn't make it out of there. They were so angry. First time we did it, this man right here, he was there in the crowd. He's about 6'7". That's Muhammad Hijab. He told all the Muslims to come in and said, do not look at what they're showing you. Do not listen to what they were saying. I will tell you everything. 4 years later, in 2020, he had an interview with this man, Dr. Yasir Qadhi. Dr. Yasir Qadhi is the world leading authority on the Quran, got his doctorate on the Quran from Yale University in 1995. So he went to Yasir Qadhi to ask him, what about these Qurans? He held his hand out. He didn't know all of us were looking. He said, what about those Qurans? I'm going to give you a blank sheet of paper. Which Quran are you going to write on this? Yasir Qadhi says, do not ask me that question. He had no idea. We were all watching. She said, this has been the most difficult problem for Muslim scholars in the last 1,000 years. We have no answer to that. He said, well, tell me, which one is it? Is it Warsh? Is it Hafs? He said, you notice I have never spoken about this in public. When Muslims are converted, or when people are converted to Islam, we don't tell them about this. If they start to hear this, we say, just accept it, don't ask questions. Once they are mature, we do a deep dive. Come and take my class. I will explain it to you. But in 25 years, I've never spoken about this in public. He said, the West is catching up with us. Because the mom said, well, is this the crisis you had at Yale University in 1995? Not a crisis of faith, crisis of knowledge. Do you see the distinction he's making? He said, well, what's your answer? What's the answer? Which Quran is it? If this is the eternal, which one of these is the eternal one? He said, the West has come leaps and bounds in the last 100 years, and they're looking at us like an emperor with no clothes. What an admission. He says, we in Islam, we have a respect for our Quran, and there are certain things we don't ask. We have a red line beyond which we don't go. This is one of those red lines. But when I went to Yale University, there were no red lines. You can ask any question you want. So we are now taking out those red lines. And then he finally said, after 28 minutes, Dr. Qadhi, which is the Quran? Tell me, which is the one? Which is the one that's the eternal one? Which is the one that was revealed to Muhammad? Which is the one that Uthman wrote in 652? Tell us. And he says, they're all the Quran. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. You stir them around and that's the Quran we get. And I just started clapping. See, Dr. Yasir Qadhi does not know that what we now know. There are 93,000 differences between these Quran. There is no such thing as a Quran that comes from God. It doesn't even come from Muhammad. It doesn't even come from Uthman. It's up on Fander Films. Go up and see it. In fact, every June 8th, I do another presentation just on that. June 8th, I do a yearly unpacking. So go back on June 8th on Fander Film. I unpack it for everybody again. Just to remind the Muslims that this is going to be an anniversary we're going to remember. After that happened, they had it up on both of their YouTube sites. They have half a million subscribers on both of their sites. Within 2 weeks, there were so many Muslims that had left Islam. Hundreds of Muslims had left Islam. They were saying, our blood is going to be on your shoulders because of what you have admitted. They had to take off all the comments within 2 weeks. Within 2 months, by August of 2020, they had to shut down both of those interviews. They deleted them from their site because so many hundreds of Muslims had left Islam. Now, they haven't become Christians yet. That's the next step. We've got to bring them home. Can you see how much damage that 5'2" woman did? Hatun Tosh. She's at Speaker's Corner every Sunday. Go and support her. She'll be there next Sunday. Get there at 3:30 and just give her a hand and help protect her because she is getting beat up by the Muslims, physically beat up. They tried to kill her a year ago. You're right. They stabbed her in the head. God protected her because she got up within 10 minutes, blood all over the place, and she kept on preaching the gospel. That just happened a year ago here at Speaker's Corner. Dr. Dan Brubaker did his doctoral thesis looking at the Constantinople text. Now we're going back to even more devastating. This gets better and better. When you look at those Constantinople texts that have no dots, no vowels, those earliest manuscripts, he did his doctoral thesis in 2014. He went and he was the only one to film and photograph all of the manuscripts. So we went to the Topkapi, the Samarkand, the Ma'il, the Petropolis. He went to the Husseini manuscript and the Sana'a manuscript, plus four others from the 8th, 9th, and 10th century, and photographed thousands upon thousands of films. He found 800 variants. These are consonantal variants. These are not dots and vowels. These are before the dots and vowels were added, which means these are completely different variants. Now, he came up with this book here. You can buy it. These are just 22. Because now, as of 2019, he has found 4,000 variants. 4,000 consonantal variants, just 22 of them. What has he found? He's found insertions. He found erasers, overwritten, coverings, tapings. Here's a picture of some insertions. You see the words put above the line? Can you see them? You can visually see them. These should not be there. They've been added at a later date. There's erasers where they've erased it, certain letters and words, to change the word. In every case where there is an eraser, it has now conformed to the Hafs text, the ones we're using today. This is the Hafs text. I'll tell you about that in just about 5 minutes. Then he found also what they call overwriting without erasers, where they just wrote over top. They didn't even bother to censor it. And then he found selective coverings. These are the most damaging because there's entire words. Take a look at this one here that has 8 different coverings on it. It just looked like chicken scratches by the time you're ended. In every case, they have covered it over, so it now corresponds with the Hafs text that we're using today. Here you found selective coverings that are overwritten. And then he found tapings, where they're taping entire sections to censor it and standardize it. Now, we went up in 2019 when I was here last, and I went up on the ladder with Hatun Tosh, that's her on the left, and Mansur Ahmad, who is considered to be either the world authority or soon to be the world authority on the Quranic manuscripts. He is the one in the Islamic Awareness website. He has all the manuscripts up there. He is the one that writes them and supports them. He got on a ladder next to me to confront me, and he made the claim that they can trace back the Quran all the way to Uthman, a textual tradition all the way back to Uthman. You need to watch and see what happened. In 30 minutes, we shut him down. Why? Because I said, okay, where is the one from Uthman? He couldn't answer. I said, okay, where is this manuscript you're talking about from 652? He couldn't answer. I said, well, what about the late 7th century? He couldn't answer. I said, okay, where are you? What are you talking about? He says, from the first century of Islam, we have now got the complete Quran, at least 96%. I said, 96% of a complete Quran from the first century? That goes from 522 up to 719. 719 is 8th century. You have a complete Quran? Where is it? He says, we have it, Mr. Smith. I said, okay, let's see where it is. So I went up onto his website, and here it is. That's the complete Quran that he's talking about. It's 63 fragments. It's not one Quran. It's 63 fragments that they put up there on their website. What's more, 20 of them that I'm putting up there right now are tentatively dated. They have no way of knowing what dates they are, and there's disagreement between the scholars, so they should never have put those 20 up there, but they needed them to fill up the list. 9 of them are all after 719, so they should not be on the list, including the largest one, which is the Ma'il Quran, which is 50% of the Quran they get just from that one manuscript. Throw that out. And the other 34, no one's done any research on. So they're just making it up as they go. Can you see what they have done? They didn't think any of us would ever look at this. They didn't think any of us would ever hold them to account. We've known all about these manuscripts. We know where they all are. My team has actually researched every one of these 63 fragments, and we shut them down right there on Speaker's Corner. Thus, none of them are really valid. Since all of them are either late or tentatively dated or have no supporting evidence, there is no complete Quran for the first 100 years after Muhammad. The Muslims have had to collect 63 fragments of the Quran to find even 96% by 719, yet almost all of them are either tentative or no supporting evidence. Some of their dates go even as far back as the 9th and 10th century. They have not studied any of them to know if any, even they agree with the current Quran we have today. So how did we get this Quran? How did we get this one I'm holding in my hand? This is the Hafs text that every one of you use here in London, here in England. Any of you know where this came from? Yeah, this guy's good. He knows everything. Well done. I should have you up here talking. 1924, in Cairo, Egypt, 98 years ago, they were doing standardized tests in the high schools just in the city of Cairo, and they noticed that all these students were coming up with different answers. Why? Because they were coming from families that had memorized the Qur'an in Warsh or Hafs or Al-Qasai, or whatever your name is, let's just put your name as Al-Jalad. All of them were memorizing in a different way, and they could not have standardized tests. So they went to the Al-Hazad University, which is the penultimate university in the Islamic world, and they went to Al-Huzaini, Muhammad Al-Huzaini Al-Haddad, who is a scholar there, and they asked him to choose one of those 30, and he chose this one, right here. This is the Hafs text. Why? Because it's the one the Ottomans had chosen. Why? Because it's closest to them. It's in Kufa. It's the most simple of all the texts. This man died in 796. Muhammad died in 632. This is 144 years after him. This man lived in Kufa, never ever went down to Mecca or Medina. Yet they chose this text as the official text. So what did they do with the other 29? They took them out into a boat and threw them into the Nile, thinking that would get rid of them. But that still wasn't good enough because there were so many differences, so many problems. They had to make 7 different changes with this text so that 1936 they finally came out with their authoritative text for all of Egypt. And they made it the official text for this country of Egypt. Excuse me. They call it the Farouk edition, named after King Farouk, who came to power that year. That became so successful in Egypt that the Saudi Arabians, seeing how successful that was, then chose the Hafs text for Saudi Arabia and the whole world in 1985. Show of hands, how many people were alive in 1985? Most of you, which means all of you who have raised your hands are older than this Quran. How didn't that make you feel old? Now, we're going to end with this. Now we're coming to the best part. Remember I told you that back in the 7th century, they did not have a Quran. There was no Quran. We don't have anything from the 7th century. We know that from the manuscripts. So what did they have? Well, according to the Inara group, the German scholars, they are the ones who have split this wide open. And it had to do with this man here, Dr. Günter Lulling. In 1970, he wrote his doctoral thesis on looking at hymns or poetry in the Quran, which is a lot. There are about 30% of the Quran is beautiful poetry. And he said, I've seen this poetry before. And so he decided to take off the dots and put Aramaic dots on, and suddenly the poetry came to life. These were Christian hymns written in Aramaic, written in the fourth, most of them from St. Ephrem in the fourth century. St. Ephrem, fourth, fifth, and sixth century, taken out of the Aramaic, interposed into Arabic, and doing that, putting their own dots in. He wrote it as his doctoral thesis. He got the Examen Opus, which is the highest grade you could get in Germany. If you get the Examen Opus in Germany, you are given professorship automatically. He was not given professorship in 1972. He was stripped of his title, thrown out of the university, and put into obscurity for 30 years and lived on welfare. Why? Because of what he had found. I went to visit him in 1999. I didn't go to visit him. I went to visit Dr. Gerd Pwin, who was the one that did on the Sana manuscript. He wanted me to see this fellow, so he went to his house, met him and his wife, and he told me his story. I said, well, where is your thesis? Give it to me. He says, well, it's in German. I said, put it into English, and we'll translate it for you. So I brought it back to London. Now, the problem with academic German is that one sentence can be 400 words long. try to translate that, and I don't know any Germans, and I tried to find a German translator, and they just had headaches. So finally we got it translated, sent it back to him. He took it to India, the only place that would publish it, and that's the picture of the book. You can get it on Amazon. That book now has resurrected him. He is now, his name is all over the world. He has been resurrected. He died in 2015, a happy man, because we got it into English. Because of what he did with that book, this man here came and wrote this book. This is called The Syro-Aramaic Reading of the Quran. Dr. Christoph Luxembourg, another German scholar who is an expert in Syriac, Aramaic, saw what Dr. Günther Lulling had done, and in the year 2000, he wrote this book. What he did is he noticed that, and this is the case, if you look at the Quran today, about 25% of the Quran makes no sense. You won't understand it, I don't understand it, even the scholars don't understand it. These are known as the dark passages of the Quran. You probably don't know this, but any scholar knows this. They just make no sense. So he decided to do the same thing that Dr. Günther Lulling, but he put it into seven different layers. So he looked first at, I won't go through all the seven, you can go through all the seven. He just unpacked it, took out all the dots, put in new dots, went back to the lexicons, went back to the Syriac. He was able to reproduce all of the 25% dark passages. And guess what he found? He found that all of these dark passages were Christian lectionaries, homilies, and hymns. And they were all about Jesus Christ. The original Quran is all about Jesus. It's all about hymns and homilies praising Jesus. Which means it has nothing to do with what they found, it's who they found. Folks, we need to go back and resurrect the Quran and take it back to its original text. And what we're going to do is we're going to bring him home. We've got to bring him home to Jesus Christ. Let's do conclusions. None of the five Uthmanic metropolitan Qurans exist today. The Meccan, Medina, Basra, Kufa, Damascus, they don't exist. The six earliest 8th to 10th century Qurans are not complete, nor are the same, nor do they agree with the Hafs texts. The Birmingham folios are only 33 verses taken from 512, 145, and 1400 BC. The 30 Qirat Qurans were created between 736 to 905, were chosen by Mujahid in the 10th century, then were chosen by Shatibi in the 12th century, and then finally chosen by Al-Jazidi in the 15th century. That's 800 years too late, with 93,000 differences, 5,000 just between the Hafs and the Waris texts. The June 8, 2020 interview between Hijab and Qadi proved the Quran was not perfectly preserved. Dan Brubaker's 4,000 continental variants proved massive censorship during the Ottoman dynasty. The 63 fragments proved that they were either late, tentatively dated, or had no supporting evidence whatsoever. The Hafs Quran, chosen in 1924, that's less than 100 years ago, was canonized in 1985 by King Fahd and used by 93% of the Muslim world today. Lulling and Luxembourg in the Aramaic Quran suggests that the Quran was taken from Christian lectionaries, hymns and homilies, suggesting the original Quran was all about Jesus. Let's bring them home. Now, I'm not going to go through the conclusions because we do need to end there, but I do want to open up to question and answers. Have you seen, now I want to say one thing. Have you noticed, I've said nothing hateful today. I've said nothing Islamophobic today. I have not attacked Muhammad's character. I have not attacked his violence. What have I done today? I've asked the same questions of Islam that have been asked of us. We had this kind of questioning back in the 1800s in Germany at Tübingen and also with Wellhausen, did we not? They questioned Jesus' historicity. They questioned whether or not the gospel accounts were correct. They questioned whether or not there was any place called Bethlehem or Nazareth at that time. Question after question after question. It went into the seminaries in Germany, decimated, went down into the churches. It decimated the church by 1905, along with Darwinianism. And these were perfectly good questions to ask about the Bible and the history of Jesus. Now, in the last 100 years, we have answered every one of those questions. We did not create redacted criticism. We matured redacted criticism. We matured formulate criticism. We matured historical criticism, both higher and lower criticism. We were the ones that actually went back to source criticism and actually used it to its really so that it can be usable all over the world today. But because of the fact we have done that with the Bible in Jesus Christ, we are better prepared than anybody else to do the same of any book. Don't just stop at the Quran. Go with the Upanishads or the Bhagavad Gita or the Vedas. Go to the Book of Mormon. You name it, we can ask any of these questions because we have been asked of the same. and have passed every test. Thank God for Jesus Christ. Which means we are the only ones that should be in this battle. When I left Speaker's Corner back in 2017, the last man to say goodbye to me was an atheist. He was there last Sunday. He was in tears when I left. He said, please don't leave. I said, why not? He says, because you're the first Christian we have met that's actually talking the language we want to hear. You're not telling us your testimony. You're not talking about what God has done for you, because God doesn't do that for us. What you're asking is a much deeper question. Is it true? That's what we're asking. Is it true? And can you provide the evidence from the time period, from the same place and the same people that you're claiming? That's all we're asking. That's what they asked of the Bible. That's what they asked of Jesus Christ. And we have been able to support Jesus, support the Bible, using first and second century evidence. Therefore, we are the only ones really capable, and we are the only ones who should do this. I turn towards Steve, the atheist, and says, please don't use this material. This is not for you to use. Because when you use it, you're going to destroy Islam, and you have nothing to give them. We are the only ones that have an answer. We are the only ones that have an alternative. We are the only ones that can give them, take them from the Quran and bring them back to the Bible. Take them from Isa and bring them back to Yeshua. Take them from Allah and bring them back to Yahweh. We are the only ones that can do that. This is not your battle. This is our battle. This is your battle. That's why I'm here in London, because you are surrounded by Muslims all around London. Over a million Muslims here. And this battle you can use right, left, and center, because this is not Islamophobic. This is not hate speech. Since I've been using this material in the last 4 years, I have not been called a hate preacher. I'm not getting any strikes on my YouTube. And I've gone from 20,000 subscribers up to almost 70,000 subscribers in just 2 years. Because everybody wants to hear this material. It's very visual. Notice, you don't have to know Arabic to understand what I've said tonight. In fact, from here on out, if you want to understand this book, forget about Arabic. You better start learning Aramaic. And who are the ones that know Aramaic? We do. It's the Aramaic from Syria and Jordan. They understand this book. And all my Syrian friends are plotting. We've been telling you this for years. This is our material. Come on home. We are the ones that can bring Muslims back to Jesus Christ using their Quran. Throwing out Muhammad, throwing out Mecca, and bring him home to Jesus Christ. You see, this is our battle. Because we're the only ones that have the antidote. We are the only ones that have a better God, a better book, a better book, a better man, and a better place. And his name is Jesus Christ. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for who you are. Lord, as we've been looking through these three areas, an awful lot of material tonight, and yet, Lord, everything, every bit of it is based on evidence. This is what has been asked of you. This is what has been asked of your gospel, your Bible, and we have been able to provide it because you have provided it. Lord, you knew right at the very beginning that all these stories and all these homilies and all these beautiful hymns that were being put into that Quran, they're all about you. You knew that sooner or later we were going to find out. Now, Lord, we've got to introduce this to the rest of the world. Help us, Lord. As we take this material, this evidence, as we take you, because that's what we're doing, we take you to the Muslim world so that they can come home and enjoy you forever and ever as we can. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.